Greetings and welcome back to the OU.org and www.etshalom.com. My name is Yitzchak Etshalom, and it is my privilege and honor to be teaching Sefer Shmuel, the Book of Samuel, here on our Nach Yomi program. And we are now about to embark upon one of the largest chapters in Sefer Shmuel, and that is perhaps the most well-known story in the book, and that is the Battle of David and Goliath, perhaps. And I will get to the perhaps when we get to the some of the problematic passages, but let's begin at the beginning. Vayasfu Plishtim machanehem lemelchama vayasfu socho asher liyuda vayachanu ben socho venazekah be'efes damim. So for a reason that is unclear from anything in the text, not here or later, the Plishtim, the Philistines, suddenly gathered to go to war, and they gathered in Socho, which is in Yehuda. And they camped between Socho and further south of that, Azekah, in an area called Ephes Damim. Whether it was always called Ephes Damim or only called that at this point, because Ephes Damim literally means no blood, and indeed no blood was shed for the majority of time that they were camped there, is unclear. Nonetheless, it's important to note just a little bit of geography of this. From the coastal cities, and specifically from Gat, which is a little bit inland, and where the famous giant who is going to do battle here comes from there to this area, which is southwest of Jerusalem, in an area called Emek Ha'elah, the Valley of Elah, is a series of low hills which form between them canyons or ravines known as wadis, and you can walk directly from Gat to this place just following the wadi. That will be important for the direction of retreat at the end of our chapter, at the beginning of the next chapter. In any case, that was where the Plishtim marched to, which that puts them squarely underneath the hills that include Beit Lechem, squarely to the west, but downhill, meaning underlooked or overseen by Beit Lechem. Now, one of the critical problems that I'll just a little foreshadowing on here is the problem of sequence of the text, because in chapter 16 we met David, we met David's brothers, we met David's father, we saw David take it into Shaul's palace, or Shaul's house, but rather, and become his weapons carrier, etc. And in this chapter, it's almost as if we never heard of chapter 16. We'll deal with that at the end. Shaul v'ish Yisrael nesfu v'achanu v'emek ha'elah. And so Shaul and the army gathered in Emek Ha'elah and set up their formation facing the Plishtim. So they were standing one mountain opposite the other, and the valley was in the middle. The hill of Socho faces the hill which today is referred to as Kibbutz HaLamed Hei, the Kibbutz of the 35, which is a 1948 story, and one that all of our students are encouraged to learn about the Lamed Hay and the Nativ HaLamed Hay, but doesn't belong to this form. That is where the Yisrael camped, and in the middle is a valley which is known as Wadi Samet. That is the name of that ravine in the middle, and it goes pretty much parallel to the road. The road that goes in between those two hills is going right near that wadi. Vayetzei Isha Beinayim. Isha Beinayim seems to be the middleman, or the guy who goes out in the middle. Mimachanot Plishtim, Goliath Shmo. Now, at this point, we're told that his name is Goliath. However, throughout nearly all of the narrative, he is not called by name, but rather HaPlishti, and for reasons that we will get to only at the end of Shmuel Bet, we will have to cast some doubt as to the identity of this giant, because of the mention of another Goliath who was defeated in a separate battle, it seems to be mentioned there. And the question is whether or not this giant really had some other name, and somehow Goliath got pinned on the one or two times that it's mentioned as an association with the fact that he comes from the town of Gat, Goliath Migat. Goliath Shmo Migat, Govho Shesh Amot Vazaret. He's six Amot, which could be anywhere between 8 and a half, and all the way up to about 10 feet tall, and a finger's breadth. And the value of putting in Vazaret is that we don't read Sheshamot as some sort of an approximation and exaggeration, but the text is giving us a sense that this is an exact height, which is humongous, of course, even in the modern world, certainly in the ancient world. And let's hear what it is Bnei Yisrael see when he comes out. He's giant. He has a copper helmet on his head. And he's wearing male armor, which is interlocked as scales. That's kaskasim, as scales on a fish. And the weight of the armor is 5,000 shkalim of copper. Meaning that he's carrying a huge, heavy load just on his body. He has some sort of a cover of copper over his feet to protect him. And between his shoulders, he has a copper lance, which means he could then reach up behind his neck and reach out, and he's got the lance to grab. And the handle, this is now the handle of the spear, or of the lance, is like a weaver's loom, and that's a phrase that's going to come back in Shmuel Bet. V'lahevet chanito, the lahevet is the blade. Shesh miot shkalim barzel, it's 600 shkalim of metal, of iron. V'nosei hatzina olech lefanav. In the meantime, he's got a fellow walking in front of him who's carrying a shield to protect the lower part of his body. So he's got all this stuff that he's carrying, and a weapon. And the weapon is huge, and the armor is huge, and he is huge, and he's got a guy walking in front of him, which makes him basically impregnable. But on the other hand, so what? It's one guy. We're talking about an army, the Philistine army against the Israeli army. Now what happens when he walks out? Vayamod vayikral marchot Yisrael. So he called out to the army. Vayomer lahem. Lama titzu laroch melchama. Why go out to go to battle? Hello, anochi aplishti, I'm a plishti, v'atem avadim l'Shaul, and you are slaves of Shaul. V'rulachem ish v'yarein elai. You pick one guy, and let him come out to me. In other words, he turns this war into a mano a mano, a man-on-man, a one-on-one battle, with the following consequence. Im yuchal hilachem iti v'ikani, if he can stand up to me, which is laughable at this point, and he kills me, v'ayinu l'chem l'avadim, we will become your slaves. But if I can beat him and kill him, you will become our slaves, and you will work for us. You will be enslaved to us. Now notice, he doesn't say the same thing in the first half of the clause. We will be your slaves and we'll be enslaved to you, because in his mind, it's just an impossibility. Now, the real question that is not answered at all is why the Israeli army and why Shaul buy into this. Why don't they say, we're not interested in you, we're not interested in your conditions, we're going to war, let's go to war. And somehow he has them tantalized, he has them paralyzed with his threats and his taunts so that they don't have any response. And thus, he said, I have shamed the army of Israel this day. Send me out a man and let's fight. So what he's done is he's turned a war that may be political, maybe territorial, maybe issues of control, he's turned it into a personal affront. I have shamed you, send out one guy and let's go at it. So they heard this plishti's words and they were very much afraid. Now it's very hard to imagine that the Israeli army, who knew the plishtim well, and had already gone to battle and had beaten the plishtim earlier, that suddenly they would think that all the plishtim were dressed like this and were this tall and this strong. They have to understand that this is some unique character that they otherwise have not had any contact with, and that if they were to just go to war, then he would be one significant player, but that would be it. And for some reason, they really are paralyzed by his words. But there is one thing in his words I want to take another look at. He says, I have embarrassed, I have shamed the armies of Israel. How did he shame the armies of Israel? What did he say? What did he do that was so shameful? What was the cherpa? And of course, Goliath likely didn't use that word. He was likely speaking some other dialect. And so the author, capital A, of Tanakh has the Nevi'im write it this way, which means he wants to communicate something to us about what Goliath has done. We'll leave it in the meantime, but we'll get to it a little bit later. In the meantime, we are introduced to a character that we know all too well, the David ben Ish Ephrati Hazeh. David, who was the son of this man from Ephrat, mi Beit Lachem Yehuda, Ushmo Yishai. What's the name of the man from Beit Lachem? His name is Yishai. V'lo Shmo Na'avanim. He has eight sons. We knew that. V'ayish b'mei Shaul Zaken Ba'avan Hashem. That's new information that Yishai is old and he's already coming in his years, which is biblical idiom for close to death. V'ayachush Losh b'nei Yishai Ha'gdolim. Halchu Acharei Shaul L'melchama. So the three eldest, who we already met, Avinadav, Eliav, Avinadav, and Shema, followed Shaul to the war. V'shem shleish manav shalchum machama Eliav b'chor v'shnei Avinadav v'shlishi Shema, and we're given the names again. Now we find out that Eliav is the b'chor, but we kind of guessed that from the earlier chapter. David u'akatan, and David is the youngest, which means all we hear about is the three oldest, number eight, and the ones in the middle we don't hear about. U'shlosha gdolim achor acharei Shaul. Now, this pasuk is repeating, forget about what it's repeating in the previous chapter, it's repeating what we just saw in the last pasuk, that these three went out and David didn't. But it's setting up an apposition, that these three are the three heroes of the family, the three eldest, they're going out to war. David, in the meantime, is the katan, he doesn't go out to war. What happened in the middle four? They evidently didn't go out to war either, but they're really of no consequence in our story. David holech vashav mi'al Shaul, he wrote at son aviv beit lachem. In the meantime, David is going back and forth above Shaul, which means he's walking and grazing he is shepherding the flock. He's not grazing, he's shepherding the flock above Shaul. Keep in, able to see the war from above there and look down at the battlefront and see what's happening. Vayigash haplishti ashkem v'harev v'yatsev arbaim yom. And in the meantime, what's happening down there? The plishti is standing up. The Philistine, no, it's not Goliath, but the Philistine is standing up morning and evening, whether it means he gets up early in the morning and stands there all day until the evening, or he goes out once in the morning, once in the evening, but this goes on for 40 days. And of course, there's a lot of symbolism in Hashkem V'Harev, which Chazal pick up on Kriyat Shema, and Arbaim Yom, of course, is associated with Matan Torah, and with Eliyahu's visit to Har Chorev. Vayomer Yishai David beno. So in the meantime, we go back to Beit Lechem. And what does Yishai say to David? Kachnali achach haifata kaldi azev, asara lechem hazeh. Take an ephah, which is about 30 kilograms, of toasted corn, and 10 loaves of bread, v'haretz ha-machane le'achicha, and take it to the camp for your brothers. Your brothers have been at war now for 40 days, and you gotta go bring them some provisions. V'yataseret charitzei ha-chalav ha-eileh. Charitzei ha-chalav really are things of cheese. Dairy slabs. Tavila sarha aleph. Bring them to the general. Tachacha tifko the shalom and check up that your brothers are doing well. That's arubatam tikach and bring back some sign that they're alive. An aruba meaning sort of a guarantee. Bring back a guarantee that they're alive. A sign that they're alive. Now, Yishai parenthetically demonstrates what we've already seen in Perek Tet Zion, which is that he has a sense of diplomatic acumen and a sense of protocol. When he sent David to Shaul, he sent a whole bunch of food as a gift. Now he's not only sending a care package to his sons at war, but he's also sending what we would call it in camp terms, a tip to the general who is in charge of them, which would ensure, of course, that they would probably be treated better than others. What happens, parenthetically, v'atachacha tifkod l'shalom v'atarabatam tikach, is famously interpreted midrashically as the source for the idea that when people would go out to war, they would deliver a conditional divorce writ, so that if they would not return from war, their wives would be divorced retroactively. But that, of course, is not what the pshat is. That the aruba tam tikach, and aruba is something which is a guarantee. Bring back a guarantee that they are alive. In the meantime, Shaul and the three brothers and everybody else are all in the valley fighting. Now that's an ironic and a sort of sardonic statement. They're not fighting, they're not doing anything. They got their tail between their legs and their chicken, and they're listening to this plishti threaten them day in and evening out, and doing nothing. But officially they're at war. Such a war. So David did exactly what his father said. He got up early in the morning. And he left the flock with some sort of a guard. He said, you hold my flock. I've got to go do father's bidding. Now, I noted in the last chapter that David is presented in the text as very much of a latter-day Yosef. Scorned by his brothers, separated, perhaps he's from a different mother, unclear. He's not connected and the brothers don't regard him. Of course, in the story of Yosef, they regard him all too well, but they certainly distance him, and he ends up being an outcast. Here there is another parallel with Yosef, is that father sent Yosef, and in this case sent David, to a threatening situation to the brothers, and we will find that the brothers, just like in the story of Yosef, do not take very kindly even to David's presence there, and think him to be uppity for even coming there, and of course, like Yosef, he proves that he really is worthy of that position in the family. So, and he went just like Yishai commanded him. The Ma'agala is the circle where they're camped, which is not the front. It's where they're hanging out. In the meantime, they would have shifts. So the guys would go out to war. They would give a big battle cry as if anything's going to change. And then they would come back and forth. In the meantime, what does David see? And here it's important because the text already told us that. We know that we have two camps facing each other, so why is the text repeating it? To tell us what David sees. David comes and sees these two camps facing each other. He sees the circles. And what does David now hear? He took all of his vessels, Aliyat Shomer Kelim, and he left them with a Shomer Kelim, evidently a fellow whose job was to hold on to the tools and the weapons, not the weapons, but the tools and the vessels and certain kind of clothing worn by the army that they wouldn't need for war, and he would watch it. So David is sort of appropriating himself as a member of the army here. He's taking advantage of the lockers that are there. And he ran out to the front. And he found his brothers, or he looked for them, to see if they're okay. Of course, what's not to be okay? Not one shot has been fired, to use a modern idiom. So he was talking to his brothers. And again, this guy comes. And now, for the only the second time, we are told what his name is. Goliath. Another time, it's just Haplishti. But again, Goliat Migat has a certain bounce to it, a certain rhyme, and that seems to be what David is saying. Who's this guy coming out? Goliat Migat. And now we don't have to repeat everything that he said. I'm this, and you're slaves, and come send one guy out to me, etc. He just says the same thing. Vaishma David. What happened whenever the army saw him? They got frightened and they ran away. Now here's David, he's a kid, he comes to the battlefront, he sees that all of the legendary soldiers of Shaul, this one guy comes out, says what he says, and they're running away. And so the army said to each other, have you seen this guy? He's coming out to shame us. And the person who kills him, what will happen? Yashrenu HaMelech, Osher Gadol, the king will give him great wealth. He'll give him his daughter in marriage. And his family's house will be free of taxes. So it's a great reward waiting. So clearly the king is very desperate. He's put up three great rewards for anybody who will successfully go into the ring and take Goliath down. Now, Vayomer David al Anashim ha'omdimi mole mor. So David heard this, but maybe he wanted them to say it again. Maybe he wasn't clear on what he heard. Maybe he wanted to do something else, which I'll suggest in a second. What will happen to somebody who kills this plishti? And then David ends with something more powerful. And he relieves us of the shame that he's put on Israel. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine? That he has cursed or shamed the armies of the living God. Now, that is David's take. And notice what David's added in. He doesn't just say, what will happen to the guy who kills this enemy? But rather, this plishti, this arel, who has shamed us. Who is this guy to shame the army of the living God? That is David's take. David, therefore, has now broadcast to anybody who's listening that there's a new kid in town, and this kid is in the camp. And not only does he seem to not be afraid, but he also is getting the word out that the issue should not be the wealth and the reward. The issue should be the relief of the shame over all of Am Yisrael. So the people told him the same thing. This is what will happen. Be wealthy and the daughter, etc. So here we go. Eliav, his eldest brother, heard that he was talking to people and asking these questions. And Eliav got angry at him. Why did you come down here? Why did you leave the flock out there? Midbar, by the way, is not a desert, as we see several times in Tanakh, notably Shmot Gimel Aleph, but also here it's a grazing area. I know that the evil of your heart. I know what you got cooking, Zedoncha, and the evil of your heart. You came down to see the war. You didn't come down to bring us food and to check how we are. You came down to see the war. And David gives an answer which is somewhat cryptic. What did I do? Halo davarhu, which may mean it really is something. Is it not something, this war? Well, it's not so bad to come down and see it. Or he may mean, I just spoke. Hello, Davarhu. I just said words. Why are you getting on my case that I just asked a question and made a comment? So David turned away from his brother. And he asked the same question. What will happen to the person who gets rid of the shame? And he makes this whole speech. And the people told him an answer just like the one that he just heard. In other words, David already has the information. Why does he keep asking? Because he wants Shaul to hear about this. He wants Shaul to know somebody has come into the camp who's ready to go to do battle. And the words came to Shaul. Shaul heard that there was a guy in camp who was asking these questions. And if you can imagine, from Shaul's perspective, this is a breath of fresh air. Suddenly, there's somebody in the camp who's ready to consider going into the ring with Goliath. So now what happens? Vayomer David al Shaul. So David is now brought to Shaul, and he says, Al yipol lev adam alav. Don't get depressed. Avdecha yelech. I will go v'nelcham al plishti hazeh. I will fight this plishti. Vayomer Shaul David, lo tuchal lechad al plishti hazeh l'achim imo. You can't go and fight him. Why? Ki na'arata. You're a kid. V'u ish v'chamam minu rav. Look at the play. You're a na'ar, and he is a battler since he was a na'ar. In other words, you're just a kid, and since he was a kid, he's a man of war. Now, of course, this very much upsets the sequence of the text in which David, in the previous chapter, was already made into Shaul's weapons carrier, should have been at the front the whole time, was already described as a man of war and a valiant fighter in the previous chapter, and here Shaul, who may or may not know him, says, you're just a kid, and he's a battler. So David tells a story. Vayomer David al Shaul. I was a shepherd for my father with the flock. This is clearly two different stories. A lion came and a bear came. In each case, took one of the lambs. I went after him. In each case, and I smote him. And I saved the lamb from his mouth. And then it came and attacked me. And I grabbed its beard. And I smote him and I killed him. Gam tari, gam hadovikav dech. I killed a lion, I killed a bear. Vaya plishti, arela zek yachad mehem. Should this plishti be even as strong as they are? Ki cheref marchot elim chayim. And then he adds again this twist. He has shamed the army of the living God. He shamed our army. So he's lower than a, it's easier to take. The argument is an interesting one. Now notice, David made this argument. And David is talking, and the next verse says, Vayomer David, which is strange, because David is talking, and there's been no action in the middle. So why does it say Vayomer David? A number of years ago, in the 60s, Meir Shiloach wrote a very important article that was part of Sefer Korengrin, in which he went through all of the different instances of what he referred to as Vayomer, Vayomer, where one speaker is speaking and is introduced with Vayomer in his name, and he speaks, and then in the middle of his speech it says again Vayomer and his name, although there's been no interruption. And he went through all of the different examples and categorized them into different reasons why the text would be presented that way. And one of the most common ones, and really most of them fall into this in a general way, is where the speaker speaks, and then there is some sort of a break or an anticipation of a response. And when the other party doesn't respond, the original speaker picks up and continues, and the text telegraphs that there was some sort of an anticipation or some sort of a break in the middle by adding Vayomer again. Classic example of this is where Reuven, when Yosef shows up, the first thing that happens is Vayomer Reuven al Achav, Vayomer Reuven, let's take a look at it. We'll see it together. It's in Perek Lamed Zayin of Breishit. It's worth looking up. Take a look in your Tanakh in Breishit Lamed Zayin. It'll be around Pasuk Chaf, towards the middle of the Perek. And here we have exactly in Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Vayishma Reuven vayatzilei miyadam. Reuven heard that they wanted to kill him. Vayomer lo nakenu nafesh. And he said, let's not kill him. And then Vayomar Alehem Reuven, and he said to them, Reuven said to them, don't kill him, throw him in the pit, etc. Now, you notice what happened is the first thing Reuven said was, don't kill him. It had nothing to do with, let's throw him in a pit. Well, don't kill him. Don't do anything to him. Don't hurt him. Evidently, Reuven saw that the brothers weren't buying it. So then Reuven continues and gives a milder form, which he thinks will eventually save Yosef, which is, okay, let's not kill him by hand. Let's throw him in the pit. He'll die on his own. There are many other examples of this, and a classic example is in Bamidbar Perek Lamed Bet. In Perek Lamed Bet of Bamidbar, Numbers 32, we have at the beginning a description after the conquest of Transjordan, of the East Bank, by Am Yisrael. We find that the text tells us that Reuven and Gad, those two tribes, had lots and lots of cattle. And they came to Moshe, Vayavovene God of Neruven, Vayimura Moshe V'yal Al-Azhar, Kohen V'al-Siyah, Dan Lemur. They said the following. And they described the lands, Atarot, V'divon, etc., etc. Ha'aretz Asherikah, Adonai L'fnei Adat Yisrael, Eretz Mikanehi, V'lavadecha Mikaneh. It's a land that is fertile for grazing, and we have a lot of cattle. And the next pasuk is, Vayomru, Immatzanu Chein V'enecha, and then it's, and they said, if you approve, then give us this land. Why did they have to say, why did they have to, Vayomru, what's the Vayomru about? Rather, evidently, they waited to hear Moshe say, oh, you got a lot of cattle, it's a good land for grazing, why don't you stay there? Moshe, in his tremendous wisdom, remained silent. I'm not going to pick up on their hint. If you want something, ask for it. And so they were forced to ask, which allowed Moshe to give them all of the rebuke and chastisement he gave, which ultimately led to the negotiations and the agreement on their part to first come and do battle Aver HaYarden. The same thing happens here. David said to Shaul, told him a story about the lion and the bear, and if I beat the lion and the bear, I can beat this Plishtim. And Shaul doesn't respond. So now what happens? Vayomer David, Adonai Ashrit Sinanu Miyad Ari Miyad Adov, Hu Yatzli Miyad HaPlishti Hazeh. He then said, God who saved me from the lion and the bear, he'll save me from this plishti. And then, Vayomer Shaul David, Lech v'Adonai Yehimach. Then Shaul said, go and God will be with you. In other words, Shaul understood. This kid may be great, but if he doesn't understand that God is a central part of his victory, we ain't going nowhere. So as long as David said, I beat the lion, I beat the bear, Shaul said nothing. David understood this. So he rephrased it, and he said, God, who saved me from the lion and the bear, he'll save me. And what is Shaul's response? Go and let God be with you. Indeed, that is how you will be saved. Vayabesh Shaul David Madav, v'natan kova nachoshet al rosho, vayabesh oto shiryon. And so now Shaul put his own uniform on David, and he put a copper helmet on his head, and he put armor on him, which was very symbolic of Shaul taking the royal battle garb and putting it on David. Again, David becoming the king here, although nobody seems to be aware of it. So David then strapped on the sheath and the sword over his uniform, and he tried to walk. Kiloni sa, but he never walked in this stuff before. He was a shepherd. He was used to be having very light garments and running. And he said to Shaul, I can't walk in these things, I'm not used to them. And he took them off. And he took a stick in his hand. Now we've got to imagine, Goliath is watching this. He took a stick in his hand. He went down to the riverbed, which is in between them. Now remember, it's a ravine, which means this battle is undoubtedly taking place in the summer. But it's a riverbed, which means in the winter there's water there. So the rocks in the riverbed are going to be smooth rocks. Smooth rocks mean aerodynamically fit rocks. rocks that will fly because they will not have anything to drag them down, any juttings out. Evidently, he had some sort of a pouch, and he put the rocks in the pouch, and evidently, Goliath didn't see it. He also had a slingshot. Now, a slingshot is not what we imagine, maybe we saw in old Dennis the Menace cartoons or something, but rather it is a pouch that has two strings, a string coming out from each side, and you hold the two strings together, and in the pouch you place a little rock or a pellet or whatever it may be, and you swing these two, this whole piece together, and at the critical moment you let go of one of the strings. The whole thing opens up, and if you know how to aim it, it can really hurt. It will go very, very fast. And I myself have witnessed at this spot, at Tel Azekah, somebody sling a rock. And you didn't see it, but you heard it, and you can imagine being on the receiving end would not be very friendly. So he took these things. Vaygashal haplishti, approached the plishti. And now we're getting to the critical meeting point. Vayedach haplishti olech v'karev al David, so the plishti was coming closer to David. Vayishto sat sinalafan. In the meantime, his weapons, his shield bearer, is walking in front of him. Vayabeta plishti vayret David vayiv zehu. Now notice, it doesn't say v'charpehu, which is the word we've used earlier. Goliath saw the plishti, saw David, again, it's haplishti, haplishti, saw David, and he degraded him. Ki'anar, first of all, he was a kid, v'admoni is already, meaning as if he's always out in the sun and never wearing armor. Imyefemare, he's also very good looking. I'm just picturing Goliath with a few missing teeth and sort of looking like a hockey player. V'yor plishti al David, l'chai ilai v'etnat p'sacha l'of ha'shamayim v'mat ha'sadeh. And this is what we commonly call trash talk. The plishti said to David, Vayomar plishti al David, hachelev anochi? Am I a dog? Ki ata ba'elav maklot? You're coming at me with sticks? And as he saw the stick in David's hand, and the plishti thought it laughable. He said, this is a kid who's a shepherd, and he thinks I'm just going to be as pliable as sheep, and I'm some sort of a dog. Vaykala plishti al David be'elohav, and he cursed David by his own God. And the plishti said to David, come here and I'm gonna turn your flesh into buzzard meat and to food for the animals in the field. In other words, I'm gonna kill you. So David said to the plishti, and you're coming with a sword and a spear and a lance. I come in the name of the God of the army that you have shamed. Again, we don't know where the shame is. We'll have to talk about that in a moment. But that's what David's response is. Now, a big question to deal with here is, does David mean it? In other words, does David mean, I'm going to stand here, I'm going to use the name of God, you can come with all the weapons in the world, I'm going to beat you? Or is this a psychological ploy to make Goliath think that this David, who is unarmed and unarmored, really believes in this and get him to be overly confident, as we saw with Yonatan the Plishtim, Perek Yudalad, which will then be his undoing? Well, let's see. Hayom hazeh yisagercha Adonai biyadi vikiticha vasiroti et roshcha mi'alecha v'natati pegar machane Plishtim hayom hazeh l'of ha'shamayim v'chayat ha'aretz v'idu kol aretz ki yesh Elohim li'Yisrael. Today God is going to hand you over to my hand, put you in my hand, and I'm going to kill you, and I'm going to take your head off of you, and I'm going to turn the carcasses of the camp of the Plishtim into, and it's not just you, all of your army are going to be food for the birds and for the wild animals, and everybody's going to know that there is a God in Israel. In other words, David is turning this into a Kiddush Hashem, into a sanctification and a proclamation and publication of God's name, by the imminent defeat of the Plishti. But of course it all looks laughable. The Plishti with all of his armor and his weapon and his strength, and here is David the kid. And all these people are going to know that God does not need a sword and a spear to win, because God owns the war. And he'll hand you over to us. In other words, your spears don't frighten me. Your weapons, your armor doesn't frighten me, because God is in charge of the war. That's what David is saying. So as the plishti got up, coming at David, ready to kill him, David ran at him, which must have certainly surprised him, because he must have thought, after all that, David would run away. And David reached into his pouch, took out one rock, and slung it. And he hit the plishti in the one vulnerable place he had, which was his forehead, underneath where the helmet went. Listen to this description. The rock sunk into his head. And he fell on his face onto the ground. In other words, the plishti fell forward. Now, why did he fall forward? Normally, you'd fall backwards. Well, part of it is the weight of all of this armor and the weight on his back. But that really should pull him back. But remember, he's running downhill. So the force of his running and the force of the direction is going to bring him down. So he falls on his face. And now summing it up, David beat the plishti with the slingshot and the rock. And he killed the plishti, cherev ein biyad David, without a sword. Yes, without a sword, but yes, with a weapon. A wise warrior knows how to turn his opponent's strength against him and to turn his own weakness in his favor. David's weakness here is that he is unarmed, weaker, smaller, and that's the strength of Goliath. On the other hand, that strength also slows him down, also keeps him covered, and David is able to run back and forth, and is also able to very quickly pull a rock out and sling it at Goliath, and that's exactly what he did. We're not done. David then ran down and stood over this plishti, who's dying in front of him. He took out the plishti's sword. He pulled it out of the sheath. And then he finished him off. The same word used that the weapons carrier did following Yonatan, the beginning of Perek Yudalad. He cut off his head. The Plishtim saw that their hero was dead, and they ran away. And so now, as I mentioned at the beginning, the geography is important. The army of Israel and Yehuda suddenly got up and was screaming, and they chased after the plishtim all the way towards Ekron, all the way towards the coast. And there were carcasses of plishtim all along the road. On the way back, they came and despoiled all of the plishti camp. And this is an anachronism. David took the head of the plishti and brought it to Yerushalayim. This must mean that years later, after David ran away from Shaul, and after David became a king, and after David then finally conquered Yerushalayim and established his kingdom there, he also ended up bringing the head of the plishti there, that Kelav Sambiolo, and his weapons he put in his own tent. Now, that's the story of David and Goliath. Again, it's David and a plishti. And the reason I keep hedging on his identity is because in Shmuel Bet Chafal, if there is a record of two psukim of war between an Elchanan from Beit Lechem, who goes to war against a Goliath from the plishtim, who's a giant, and he defeats him, and there the name Goliath is all he's called. And so one of the solutions to that problem, some people made the suggestion that David's real name was Elchanan, David was some sort of a royal name. But the other suggestion was that this fellow's name wasn't necessarily Goliath. We don't know this fellow's name. And so the text calls him Goliath a couple times because, A, we do have such a character later on. And second of all, because it's a nice balance to Goliath and he got. But notice that his name really does not predominate here. It's mentioned two or three times in the whole chapter. Although that's how we constantly refer to him. Now, there is another problem which is now going to be prevalent, but before getting to it, I want to address the issue of the cherpa. Back in chapter 11, when we spoke about the attack or the threat of Nachash, who was threatening to poke out the eyes of the people of the Yavesh Gilad and called it a cherpa, I mentioned that in the ancient world, slaves were branded in that way. And we find in the Tanakh that several times that the notion of slavery is regarded as cherpa. For instance, in Yehoshua, in the fifth chapter of Joshua, when the people undergo Brit Milah, God says, I have rolled away the shame, the cherpa of Egypt, which according to at least some of the Rishonim, I believe the Radak, is the shame of the fact that you were slaves in Egypt. But there's more to it than that, and I'll just sketch this out briefly, is that Brit Milah, in a very real way, is also a brand. It is a brand that we are the slaves of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And for Am Yisrael to be slaves to any other but HaKadosh Baruch Hu is itself a cherpa. In the case of the brothers, of Yaakov's sons, who come and deceive the citizens of Shechem in Bereishit Lamed Daled, they say, we cannot give our sister to a man who has foreskin, ki cherpa hilanu. It is a cherpa. What's the cherpa? Because if you are not branded as a slave to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that means you're a slave to somebody else. And that's something that for us is a cherpa. That's why when Bnei Yisrael recircumcise at Yeshua's time, Hashem says, I've removed the cherpa of Mitzrayim. I've removed that cherpa that you were really slaves there, because now you are indeed only slaves to me. And indeed, that's what happens with Nachash. It will be a cherpa for all of Am Yisrael if you are branded as slaves in a way that's obvious, by having your eyes poked out. And that's exactly what's happened here. What is it that Goliath said that was so, or the Plishti said that was such a shame? He said to them, if you notice in his first speech, he said, I am the Plishti and you are servants of Shaul. Servants, slaves of Shaul. And then he said, come out and fight, and if you win, we'll be your slaves, but if we win, you'll be our slaves and you'll be enslaved to us. Constantly the theme of slavery, and that's the cherpa, and that's what David is saying. We're gonna lift that cherpa, lift that shame by lifting the threat of slavery and lifting the statement that we are slaves to Shaul, which is untrue. The last problem, which we will leave for the next year because it's really something that can be discussed then also, is the point of sequencing. In chapter 16, we met David, we met his family, we met his father, we met his brothers, we know that he was close to Shaul, etc. And in this chapter, it's as if we don't know about that. And Shaul doesn't seem to know about it. And it gets far worse in the next passage. Pasuk Nun Hei, verse 55, is a bit of a flashback. It goes back to the initial point of battle between David and the Plishti. V'chir'ot Shaul David yotzei likrat ha-Plishti. When Shaul saw David go out to the Plishti, Amar el Avner sar tzava, he had said to Avner, his general, Ben Mize Hanar Avner, who is this guy? Whose son is he? V'yomer Avner, chen avshacha me'alachim yadati. And Avner said, by your life, king, I don't know. V'yomer me'alach sha'al ata ben Mize ha'alim. And the king said to Avner, you find out whose son is he. And then what happens? When they came back from the battle, Avner brought David to Shaul, and he's carrying the head of the Plishti in his hands. And Shaul asked him, whose son are you? I am the son of your servant Yishai from Beit Lechem. We have to see the next couple of psukim because the chapter ending was really at an awkward place. At that point, when David was speaking to Shaul, Yonatan was standing by and he became very taken by David and they became very close. And on that day, Shaul took David and didn't allow him to return. And Yonatan David made a covenant of friendship. And Yonatan took off all of his uniform, all of his clothes, his sword, etc., his bow. And evidently he gave them to David. Say David, Shaul, Yaskil, everywhere David went that Shaul sent him, he was successful. And everybody liked him. All the people liked him, all of Shaul's servants liked him, which of course now brings us to the seeds of what will be the general theme of the rest of Shmuel Aleph, which is the soured relationship between Shaul and David, and that is a very kind way to put it. However, as I mentioned, a problem that we will tackle in the beginning of the next podcast will be the problem of the sequence of chapters 16 and 17, where chapter 17 seems to ignore everything that we learned in chapter 16 about the identity of David and his relationship with Shaul. In the meantime, everybody should have a wonderful day, and we will conquer further battles as we move along in Sefer Shmuel.